I'm Beattie Cohn Reynolds, and welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And isn't it true what the Beatles lyrics tell us? We certainly all go through ups and downs in our life, and absolutely nobody is immune from the challenges, from the stressors, from the disappointments that we all go through. And it doesn't matter whether or not you are rich or poor or black or white or gay or straight or trans. The challenges of life is what it is really, really all about. And yet, the good news is that when we are having issues, and we all have issues from time to time, the very, very best thing that we really can do is reach out and ask for help. And did you know, for example, that in the United States, there are 16 million adults, yes, million adults who are suffering from clinical depression. And when it comes to anxiety, that number skyrockets to 40 million people, you know. And when you're feeling so depressed and so anxious, as you certainly know, it interferes with the quality of our lives. It interferes with the quality of our relationships. And, you know, for example, what is depression? And I think that we really have to be clear about all of this, because we certainly all have low mood from time to time. But if we're talking about clinical depression, we're talking about depressed mood most of the day, nearly every day. Markedly diminished interest or pleasure in all or almost all activities. Again, most of the day, nearly every day. Significant weight loss when not dieting, or weight gain. Insomnia. You know what it's like sometimes, where you just simply don't want to get out of bed. Or what about that fatigue or loss of energy that you're experiencing just about every single day? Or your feelings of worthlessness or excessive or inappropriate guilt? Or what about your ability to think or concentrate, and at worst, like some of my patients, where you have recurrent thoughts of death, where you're just wondering, what is this life really all about, and do I really, really want to be here? But if you're finding that these symptoms simply are not disappearing on their own, despite the fact that you're exercising, you're meditating, one of the very, very best things, first things that I think that people should do, is to actually get a complete physical, because sometimes there are a lot of physical things that are going on in our body that can either cause or contribute or trigger clinical depression. And what are some of those things? Well, we're talking about issues like vitamin D deficiency, or what about thyroid issues or low blood sugar or dehydration? And some people get really depressed when they are withdrawing from caffeine or have certain kinds of food intolerances. So I think it's very, very easy when we're feeling down, especially in the United States, let's just go and ask our doctor for another pill, which is certainly not the first step that I certainly recommend. So just ruling out physical problems is really step number one. Now, let's assuming that everything is fine physically. Then it's time for you to decide whether or not you are really going to be willing and be serious to acknowledge and address and resolve the issues that are really continuing to get in the way of your life and your relationships. And I talk about two different kinds of issues. You know, the first kind is what I call old issues, unfinished business, skeletons in the closet. For example, problems that are stemming from your own family of origin. Abuse of various kinds, including sexual abuse, sexual assault, verbal, physical, and emotional abuse. And of course, the reality is that we all know that we cannot change history. There is absolutely nothing that we can do about anything that's happened even 2 seconds ago. But with good therapy, with good therapy, and I have, and I'm underscoring that because all therapy is not good and effective therapy. But with effective therapy, you need to be able to then work through, emotionally work through what did and didn't happen so that you are then finally able to live in the moment without having one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And a lot of people, for example, people who are only doing cognitive behavioral therapy, they don't seem to care about the past at all. And they talk about changing your mind and changing your behavior. And I'm a proponent of cognitive behavioral therapy and behavioral therapy. However, in the past 35 years that I have been practicing as a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, I have not found a way at all to be able to bypass the old issues, because I have found, just like in medicine, just like in physical medicine, we need to get to the root of the problem. Otherwise, what we're doing is we're continually just putting bandages on our wounds. And is this fun? Is it easy? Absolutely not. And of course, the very first question that I ask people who call me for therapy, I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton, is whether or not the people are actually serious. Because if they are not serious, if they are not ready to really tackle their issues and look at the root of the problem and be willing to go through some really difficult times, frankly, the therapy is going to end up being a waste of time, not only for my patients, but for myself as well. So again, there is a way to do this. And, you know, people will say to me, can you not bypass? Why do we need to go back? Why do we need to look at things that we cannot change? And I can tell you that in my personal life, I'm probably one of the most impatient people that I know. I want it yesterday, I want it now. And if there had been a way to be able to escape going through the upsets and the anger and the pain and the abuse stemming from our family of origin, I think I would have been able to figure this out many, many, many years ago. But for people who are willing to do this, I mean, it's an amazing thing how people are then finally able to live their life joyfully. Otherwise, you have that cloud that seems to always be hovering over you. But let's say that you're one of these lucky people and you don't have old issues, that your old issues are either worked through or that they were just not existent as many, many people's issues in their past were. But then you have to look at today, and then you have to try to figure out, what is it about today that's really, really bringing me down? Is it my job? Is it my relationship? And after all, in the world of relationships, we are not really doing all that well. I mean, for many people, you may not be aware that the divorce rate, as an example, for first marriages is 48%. And what do you think happens to that statistic the second time that you choose to marry? Well, that number goes up to 62%. And for third marriages, the divorce rate is 73%. So I think what's really, really important for people to do when they are contemplating marriage is not only do each of us need to be in a really, really good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically, we also have some other homework to do. We need to educate ourselves about the ingredients that go into a truly healthy relationship. And if you look at a lot of these shows, in fact, the majority of shows on television, where do you see healthy relationships? We see a lot of toxicity across the board. And I think that it is such a shame that in our educational institutions that relationship education is not considered to be as important as math and science and geography. You know, one of the things that I am so grateful about is that when I was living in Montreal, and of course you know that I am Canadian and I have dual citizenship, I was one of the three directors for the school social services program for Greater Montreal, and there were hundreds of schools, and I had a large staff. And of course, we didn't worry about budgets, and we didn't worry about money, and we were given the opportunity to design and implement relationship education courses beginning, believe it or not, at the kindergarten level. So the kids, they were able to learn about how to express anger and how to express love and how to express caring. And this is something that I think that we all could benefit from. So if you were not lucky enough to learn about all these things in your own family of origin growing up, if you were not fortunate to go to a school where there was at least some relationship education, and I'm not talking about sex education, I'm talking about real emotional relationship education, then you have a personal responsibility to yourself to learn about the ingredients that actually do go into a long-term healthy relationship. Of course, if you're only interested in hookups, then none of this is relevant at all. And of course, number three is my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. A number of years ago, I did research with 450 people in the Providence, Connecticut, and Boston area. And I devised a 10-step formula to help people actually assess who's right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. I mean, when you think about the divorce statistics and we realize that one in three women every single day in the United States are murdered by their so-called intimate partner, I think that one of the things that we can give ourselves, probably one of the greatest gifts that we can give ourselves, are the necessary skills. And it is a skill to be able to once and for all learn the ingredients that not only go into a healthy relationship, but how do we go about assessing who's right for us and who's wrong for us. And I only wish that I had known about this formula when I started to date when I was a teenager. I think it would have saved me, and I know it would have saved a lot of people an enormous amount of heartache. Again, the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And this is only for people who are really serious about learning how to make an assessment. I mean, when you think about it, we assess everything in our life. We assess our hairdressers. We assess the kind of lipsticks and moisturizers that we are going to use. We assess the credit cards that we are going to buy for ourselves. And yet, when it comes to relationships, we rarely really think about the assessment process. So that I'm hoping that I will have convinced you. I mean, today is the Ask Beattie Show 258. about the importance of getting yourself in a really good place emotionally, psychologically, psychiatrically, learning the ingredients, finally, once and for all, learning the ingredients, go into a healthy relationship, and learning my formula based on the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And what about the substance abuse issues that you have been avoiding dealing with for some time? You know, you keep saying to yourself, or you say to your partner, I can stop drinking anytime, and yet somehow that anytime doesn't seem to happen, and it is playing havoc. It is playing havoc with your body. It is playing havoc with your liver. It is playing havoc with your relationships. And I guess my question to you is today the day? Is it really the time where you are willing to be serious and acknowledge and address and resolve the issues that are maybe not causing you to drink too much or use too many pills, over-the-counter pills and prescription medications? And it's really amazing, you know, how life goes by. It goes by very, very quickly. And you don't want to find yourself at the end of your life saying, if only I had done the work to deal with my problems, whether or not they're emotional problems, psychiatric problems, substance abuse problems, relationship issues, sexual issues. And if you haven't done the work, things simply don't change by osmosis. And there are a number of other things that I want to remind you about, things that we can actually do every single day to improve the quality of our lives, the quality of our relationships, and our own physicality as well. And of course, Gary Nunn talks about this all the time, the importance of plant-based diets, the fruits, the vegetables, the grains, the fish, the nuts, also the herbs and the supplements. And again, we can make a lot of excuses why we don't do this, and yet science shows, research shows that people who on a daily basis are using plant-based diets, we are the healthiest, we live the longest. So again, you have a choice. And this is something that I ask my patients every single day when they're leaving their sessions. I ask them to think about two things. One is whatever it is that they're doing, I want them to be mindful of whether or not it is in their best interest or whether or not they are doing things that are not only not in their best interest, but they are really very self-destructive and self-sabotaging. Other things that we need to think about, and not only think about, but do every day, of course, is exercise, exercise, and exercise. Studies show, I mean, not only is it great for our bodies, do we feel better, do we look better, but mentally and emotionally, it really does make all the difference in the world, including weight training and yoga and meditation, massage, acupuncture. And something else that I really want to stress is about the importance of having supportive and positive people in your life. And for people who know me personally and professionally, you know that I have zero tolerance for toxicity of any kind. And of course, when we talk about toxicity, we usually think about chemicals in our foods and chemicals in our environment. But what I'm talking about also are toxic people. And that includes sometimes friends and family. And if you try as hard as you might to work through the issues with very difficult and toxic people, and you find that you're on a merry-go-round or you're on a roller coaster ride and not a fun ride, then what are your options? Because if we allow toxic people into our lives, they can destroy us. They can destroy us emotionally, and they can also really have a very, very negative impact on our not only our mental health, but our physical health as well. You know, other things that I want you to consider, positive visualization, having fun. There's so many stressors in our life. So dancing and listening to music and aromatherapy. And one of the other things that's so great and that I have been fortunate to do over so many years is helping others. I can wake up some morning and I can be just not feeling on top of my game. And yet after I have a therapy session and I've been able to extend myself to somebody and I see that I have been able to have some impact on this person's life, it has really made a huge, huge difference also in my own mood. And finally, you know, not everybody is a lover of pets, but studies show, and I certainly know in my own life, that getting a dog, great company, great way to meet people and socialize. And I know that we have Cha-Cha, and Cha-Cha is a bona fide therapy dog. And Cha-Cha's impact on patients who come into my office, it's really amazing. People can come in and they're feeling incredibly, incredibly depressed. And here is Cha-Cha greeting them at the door. So Cha-Cha's impact on patients, Cha-Cha's impact on our life as well has actually been very, very significant. Well, today I have a very, very special guest. A special guest actually from Asheville, North Carolina. Her name is Holly Roach Knight. And I connected with Holly actually through my husband, who is involved in working with her husband with Reverend Barber, and they're very much involved in the Repairers of the Breach and the Poor People's Campaign. And Holly wrote me and she said, "I am a lifelong student of social movements. I owe my life to the movements that broke my heart, burned me out, and sent me off in search of contemplative practices to heal and sustain me in my work in social justice organizing." When I read that, I immediately reached out to Holly and I said, "We really need to talk about this." So Holly, here you are in New York City and welcome to the Ask Beattie Show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So tell me, how did all of this begin, your journey into the social movement world? And then you say you owed your life to the movements that almost broke your heart. So what was the beginning of your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, not all of us come to contemplative practice from being you know, meditators. Some of us come to it from being activists and having our hearts broken and sending us in search of ways to sustain ourselves. You know, how do we work for the long haul for justice, and how do we kind of build the resilience that it takes to live a lifelong of, you know, resistance and participation in social justice movements?
Because the sentence that really, you know, that really hit me was that when you said, "I owe my life to the movements that broke my heart."
Yeah.
What movements that almost broke your heart?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking. You know, I think, first of all, one thing that we don't necessarily talk about enough or acknowledge in our organizing is that oppression is trauma.
Yes.
First of all, right?
Yes.
So I think that activists are exposed to and are, you know, adjacent to trauma more than we give ourselves credit for.
And it's something I have to just sort of mention that I have never heard anybody talk about before. And that was why I was so interested, you know, in having you on the show. I mean, the amount of work and time. I mean, I look at my husband, I look at Reverend Barber, I look at Cornel West, I look at your husband, I look at people around the, if we're talking about the United States, around the country, who spend hundreds and hundreds of hours away from families, not eating well, not sleeping sufficiently. And you're right. I mean, that's trauma that we never talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then we're, you know, involved in campaigns where people who are directly impacted by that work are there. They're telling their stories. Those stories are narratives of deep trauma that's, you know, backed very often by our government, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, it's really hard stuff. And I think that, listen, guys, I think we don't honestly cut ourselves a break enough in movements and just say, like, wow, this is really tough. So how am I going to care for myself going in and out of these spaces? You know, the more privilege we have, the more we can sort of elect out of sort of frontline activism.
Let me ask you this. Are you maybe not the only, but one of the only people who's ever even broached this subject?
Well, I think that there's actually a sort of a growing field of folks who are talking about this. One of the people, the groups that I would lift up is Generative Somatics. And if you, I think it's generativesomatics.com. And, you know, they're lifting up this idea that individual healing is connected to systems of oppression. So our individual healing is also politicized healing. And so they've kind of coined that term, and they talk about somatics in terms of not just healing, let's say, domestic abuse, but also healing the root causes of the domestic abuse, right? And connecting women with systems of women who are organizing to create healthier family systems that make domestic abuse, you know, irrelevant. So it's really about, you know, being a part of something that's larger than yourself, but also really taking care of yourself in the process. I think we have to add individual, you know, transformation back in to the process of collective action, you know, collective organizing.
I think what's happened, certainly in this society, I mean, we talk about stressors, whether we're talking about political stressors or family stressors. I mean, people work nonstop. People rarely, you know, sleep sufficiently. The diets that people have, I mean, the sugar that is consumed. I mean, you talk about, I mean, the coin phrase these days is self-care. And yet it seems as if certainly my patients and many of my patients do not come from oppressed backgrounds in the way that, you know, you're talking. I mean, they may not have come from the greatest of families, there may have been dysfunction, but not oppression in the way that you're talking about oppression. And yet it seems as if we're not doing a good job emotionally or psychologically, whether we're in movements or we're not in movements, to really take care of ourselves physically, emotionally, psychologically, psychiatrically. We're dropping the ball on ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, there's this, what's that saying, when the plane is going down, put the mask on yourself first.
Right.
You know, so that you can help your seatmates. Yeah, I think that's something that we really need to look at. It's, I think, an active conversation with veteran organizers who have been doing movement work for 20 plus years. You start to ask yourself, okay, what's, you know, how am I going to do another 40 years of this?
Right.
And so I want to suggest that it's more than self-care. I think self-care is great, and we appreciate it, and we need it, and you know, people tend to dismiss self-care as, you know, candles and baths and, you know, me time or journaling. And those are all good things. I would not put any of those down. I think they're all very important tools. But what I'm suggesting is that we need to go a level deeper. And we need to think about doing the internal work of transformation alongside the external work. And I'm talking to activists. You know, I'm talking to people who are engaged in social change in all the roles, right? There are many roles in social change. And I think what is needed is for us to have a contemplative practice of observation that helps us see ourselves and do the internal work of transformation and social justice, which is really about being able to see how we might get in our own way.
Isn't that the truth? And of course, it's not just in the world of social justice. I mean, I've seen this in my practice. I've seen this for 35 years, people getting in their own way. And I don't know whether you heard some of my introductory remarks, but I think that the majority of people would like to bypass doing this completely. They just want to be in the moment and forget about the past and forget about internal work. Yes. And just go about living their lives. And I wish that it could be thus. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm the kind of very pragmatic person and pragmatic therapist that if this doesn't work, let's just toss it out. And yet really being serious to look inward, mm-hmm. it's tough.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's tough, but it's really worthwhile. And it's also, for those of us who are really trying to think about the most strategic things we can be doing with our time, it's actually also strategic. And that may seem paradoxical. It may sound like, oh my gosh, you're telling me if I meditate every day that this is going to be a strategic way to change the world. This sounds crazy. Who is this crazy person on your show, right? But I would actually submit, and I think that, you know, there's a fair amount of research around this, that social change is a process of adaptive change. And adaptive change means that our current framework of thinking isn't working, and we need a new one, and something new is needed. And it means that we need to create new neural pathways neurologically in our brains, right? And that process of building new neural pathways is greatly aided by the process of meditation and self-observation. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it would be really powerful if social change practitioners widely adopted meditation as a daily practice as a way of like, hey, we take care of our teeth. Every day we brush them.
Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully, at
all
least
of these
once a day.
Healthy, wonderful recommendations you mm-hmm. were making during the first part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we do something like that for our brains? Why do we sit and stare at screens, you know, instead of reading before bed? Why don't we think about the health of our brains? And meditation is a way to keep our the neuroplasticity of our brains alive and active and able to learn.
Let me ask you something, a personal question. Our husbands are in another office right now. They are talking. Your husband is the head of communications for Reverend Barber's social movement.
That's right.
Now, I'm very curious, because your husband is a busy man, as is Reverend Barber, as is my husband, who are, you know, totally committed to the social movement world. Mm-hmm. What does your husband think about meditation? Does Reverend Barber meditate? Have you been able, hopefully, Holly, to impact their not only their thinking, but their behavior so that they can take in what you're saying because it is the truth?
Yes, yes. Well, both Reverend Barber and my husband, Reverend Roach Knight, are, you know, they're Christians. And honestly, I think Christians are some of the most resistant people to practice daily meditation. And it's not because there's, you know, they're very progressive. So it's not like, that's, you know, wrong or anything like that. I think social justice practitioners that I would really look to as meditation practitioners who are making that strong connection between social justice and doing the inner and outer work of social justice is actually a Zen sensei, Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams Sensei, who is a black woman who is, you know, did all the Zen Buddhism training to become a sensei and is teaching about, you know, is really fascinated with how change happens. And I have learned a great deal from her, and actually her teachings on adaptive change have really helped me think about what is the kind of effort that is required and needed over time to become sustainable, lasting change makers.
Well, I think that whether or not we're talking about effort with trying to keep ourselves in the best possible shape emotionally, psychologically, and physically, or whether or not we're talking about dealing with depression or improving our relationships, people have to be serious. They have to make a commitment. And what I heard you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that your husband, who is the head of communications, and our good friend, Reverend Barber, they're not serious about this. And I think that the impact is going to be something that will be ultimately self-destructive, physically, emotionally. And from what you're saying, it's also going to negatively impact the social movement. If they're not doing the work that you are suggesting, and I'm suggesting that they need to do.
Sure. Yeah, and I know that Reverend Barber does spend a lot of time, caring for his embodiment and taking care of himself and making sure that he is able to be on the road as much as he is. So, and Steve does, and I think cognitively gets that meditation is helpful and it's a good thing to do. And you know, it's really just hard to start new habits, but we do meditate together sometimes. So we can't specifically name those guys as folks who are resistant to it. However, I would say that the tribe of activists that we work with contemporarily are somewhat resistant to sitting still.
Yes.
And being silent. And there's a really strong practice of having like Netflix on your phone in the background, even just when you're in the shower. Or, you know, there's a really, really, really heavy, heavy screen usage among folks, which, you know, indie media is a lot of how activists get their information. I mean, it's important. However, I think that we do need practices that slow us down. And I think that's part of why this culture is so drawn to westernized yoga, because it's physical. But it's also breathing, and it's also presencing to the present moment, and, you know, it does help people bridge into that. So we are a very, very busy culture, and activists are the busiest people on the planet. But I do have to say there is a naturally arising desire in all of us to have peace, to feel at peace. And that's what meditation does over time. It may not do it right away. At first, it can sometimes sort of trigger cycles of thinking where we're like, oh my gosh, listen to my thoughts, I'm a crazy person. But over time, it really does help us really sink into greater peace, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you're right. People are looking for inner peace, and yet, you know, for example, Gary Null, who is a world-renowned alternative health expert and who is the founder of the Progressive Radio Network, every single day on his radio show, he is citing research studies that tell us about, you know, diets and foods and disease and what we can really do to improve the quality of our physical being and our emotional being. And one of the concepts that he has mentioned that really resonated with me was that he talks about intentional ignorance and intentional neglect. We know the things. I would say that there are many, many people, maybe not the majority of people in the world, but many, many people, we know what things are in our best interest. And we also are aware of things that are self-destructive, and yet, because of intentional ignorance and neglect and laziness and making excuses, that we end up really, really engaging in a lot of very self-destructive behaviors, which impact our bodies, our minds, our relationships, our social movements, our professions, our parenting, and everything else. And I think that the task is, how do we get people to really listen, for example, to what you're saying? I mean, you're involved in the world primarily of social movements. I mean, what have you been doing these days to get this important message out to people?
Well, thank you for asking. I have spent the last 2 years pursuing two master's degrees. One is, one is a master's degree from Naropa University which is a Buddhist-inspired university in contemplative education. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is a master's degree in social justice and community organizing at Prescott College, and which is just a really wonderful program, and it's available online. I think it's like less than $10,000 and takes a year to do. It's just, I really recommend it for people who want to pick up important skills for trying to make this world a better place, because there really are traditions we can study that can really help us do that. So anyway, plug for Prescott College.
Good.
It's such a great program. But anyway, so spending 2 years at this intersection and writing a thesis around contemplative resistance and how do we practice contemplative justice. And honestly, I've been presenting at, I presented at a conference called Contemplative Mind and Society, who has a focus on contemplative education and higher education. And we've been having this kind of ongoing discussion since then. I was able to do a webinar on contemplative resistance with them. And this fall, I'm going to be going in and spending time at Wake Forest doing a couple days of work around contemplative resistance. And it's really all like, there's it's an intersection. So you've got, you know, contemplative people coming from various spiritual traditions, you know, wanting to have a conversation about engaged, you know, social justice. And then you've got social justice people sort of limping, you know, to the meditation pillow or to the yoga mat, you know, wanting to talk about how to sustain themselves through the long haul, because activism can really get beat up doing activism.
Right.
We haven't made that explicit yet. If you're not an activist, it can be very difficult work, you know. So basically, just having that conversation for contemplatives, what is their role in resistance? You know, what is their role in social movements? And you know, I would suggest that for a lot of folks of faith, of all traditions, that being present with social movements is so important. You know, just being present, just being there, a ministry of being present with the present moment where injustice is happening.
Let me ask you this. You use the term contemplative practices.
Uh-huh.
Could you define what you mean by this? You talk about contemplative
sure.
spirituality, contemplative activism. How do you define that term, contemplative?
Absolutely. Well, the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society, the organization and conference that I was just referring to, defines contemplative practices as activities that quiet the mind in order to cultivate a personal capacity for deep concentration and insight. So examples of contemplative practices include not only sitting in silence, but also many forms of single-minded concentration, including meditation, or in the Christian tradition, they call it contemplative prayer. There's also walking meditation, which is really great for people who can't quite sit still.
Uh-huh.
And then we, you know, have focused experiences in nature. You hear a lot of people say how connected they feel when they're in nature,
uh-huh.
you know, and various kinds of perhaps Native American ritual and ceremony that are designed to create sacred space and increase insight and awareness, you know. So
there are a lot of different things that people can actually do. And I find myself, of course, saying this all the time, you know, on my show and to patients. And I guess it's just a matter of trying to motivate people. And at the same time, I have never found, Holly, that anybody ever, certainly in my world of mental health, ever really comes to a place where they want to make any changes at all until they bottom out. That is the only time that I ever get a call. Nobody ever calls and says, BD, I want to learn how to communicate better. It never, ever, ever happens. Do you find that as well, that the people who are starting to engage with contemplative spirituality and activism have bottomed out one way or another in their lives?
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In an activist speak, we call that burnout.
Right.
Yes. And yes, I have burned out many times in my life. It's a sort of a fun veteran activist conversation to sit around and talk about the campaigns that took us to our beds. We couldn't get out of bed for a week after that one, you know. Yeah, so I think that it's really important to talk about burnout because it really does relate here in terms of meditation. Meditation does a really good job of switching us from our fight or flight neurological system to our sort of rest and digest system. And in activism, and I would just say in life in general, in this culture, we are often stimulated into that fight or flight type of neurology that we hold, you know, that's meant to save our lives, but is not meant to make important decisions in our lives, right? And so it's really important for activists to be able to, and trauma, I will also say trauma clicks on that fight or flight. So it's hard for someone who's been in a traumatized situation or a trauma adjacent situation where, like, say there's a police shooting down the block, something like that. It's very hard to relax after that. We can really get locked into that sort of fight or flight mentality. So, it's really important to be able to get back into that sort of rest and digest. I feel safe, you know, and make decisions and do our organizing from that place.
Now, let me ask you this. Are there therapists, trained therapists who are actually a part of, and I hadn't really thought about this until right now, some of the social movements that you are involved in, because I think, you know, contemplative practices are great, but I don't know about you, when I'm having an issue or a problem in my life, I sure like to sit down and talk to my husband and get it out and verbalize and complain and express, whether it's the anger or the pain or the fear or the upset about whatever it is that's bothering me. Mm-hmm. And I found that for, you know, patients that I have worked with over the past 35 years, there's the inner work that one can do, you know, by oneself or with oneself, but it's also so important to be able to verbalize what's gone on, the shooting down the street, how ineffective I felt today, or how empowering I'm feeling being a part of a social movement where there's been such amazing positive impact. So are there groups, are there discussions where people are able to really get out all of these feelings?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I do think that there's, I guess a couple things that come to mind when you talk about that is that there's a sort of, if you Google healing justice, this is a sort of a conversation, a term for a conversation that's happening in movements, really about all the stuff we've been talking about, how we sustain ourselves, how oppression is trauma, how do we address trauma in our social movements, how do we address our mental health in social movements. And there's a really great podcast called the Healing Justice Podcast that I would recommend folks listen to if they have an interest in this.
But are they doing it? You see, that's the point. You know, Gary Nall talks about all the research. I talk about all the things that people need to do. And yet, you know, one can talk about it. One can think about it. One can theorize about it. One can cite study results about it. Mm-hmm. But it's about acknowledge, address, resolve, and put into action. Mm-hmm. And are people in the social movements that you're involved in, are they, you know, doing hopefully more of the, you know, contemplative practices to heal and sustain, and also to have groups, self-help groups, like 12-step programs where people can actually sit down and say, hey, I was really scared today about what happened. There were the police, there was a shooting, there was this, there was that, so that you're not internalizing all of the trauma, which always negatively impacts us emotionally, psychologically, and physically as well. Mm-hmm. So is that happening in the social movements that you're currently involved in?
That's an amazing question. And I would say not enough. I think that the healing justice conversation is happening. There is sort of a field developing around that. I think in terms of in the movement, in the trenches, it is happening. I would say that I would look to Black Lives Matter leaders like Charlene Carruthers, who wrote the book Unapologetic, I think women of color, queer women of color, are really, in particular, moving this conversation around healing justice forward in terms of practical application with communities, like in social movements. I think they are just doing really powerful, amazing work. And I know that Generative Somatics is I believe, training a number of practitioners all over the country to sort of train trainers to bring this sort of emerging consciousness around mental health and trauma in social movements, and, you know, how to bring more balance back to, you know, our movements, for our warriors. You know, they're out there fighting for all of us.
Well, you are. I mean, and it's not just, of course, men. I mean, have you seen a change in over the years in the numbers of women activists who are really out in the trenches with the men, who alongside their comrades are needing to process everything that's going on and not going on in terms of being a part of a social movement?
Yeah, I would attribute the sort of increase of sort of emotional intelligence of social movements to women.
Of course.
And the leadership, right? The leadership of women who, that has only increased, you know, since first wave feminism. You know, we've had many waves since then. And a lot of women in leadership who are, you know, disrupting patriarchal ways of being, of doing culture, of doing organizing, and who are, you know, like, I'll say, I was at a conference where a colleague passed away during the conference, and it was a conference of women, and I was struck by how powerfully and beautifully and gracefully they stopped the program, told us that we would not be doing the rest of the program as it was written today, because our colleague had passed away, and that we were going to take the next 3 hours to spend time with ourselves, to do silent and unstructured artistic, you know, self-guided artistic stuff, or walks or hikes, you know, just to really stop things and meet the needs that are emerging in this moment, you know. And I find that to be not to be gendered about things, because we know a lot about gender. We know that gender is a spectrum. But I do find that women do a really amazing job at actually responding to the needs around them, rather than just like
we always
their
have
ideas about what's going to happen.
We always have. We always have.
And that's powerful social movement skills right there.
Yes.
That's powerful.
And you find that more and more the men in these leadership positions are saying, hey, I think these women have something here, and we need to really stop. We need to take better care of ourselves. We need to process what's going on. We need to find a way to better deal with the trauma, which, of course, can only positively impact the entire social movement.
Yeah.
Are they hearing you? Are they listening better? Are they putting some of this more and more into action?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in my studies, I am seeing that this is a work that is naturally arising in very diverse movements all over the country. And I think that it's coming from, like I said, the leadership of women who are seeing the need and responding to it. But I think it's also, you know, the integration of generations of activists who realize that they're going to be doing this work for decades.
Yes.
They're going to be doing this work the rest of their lives. Because we saw, you know, our grandfathers and, you know, marching for civil rights, and now they're, you know, grandchildren and great-grandchildren are still getting mowed down in the streets by cops who are not being indicted for you know, the shootings. So I think that, you know, we've had a sobering time in history where these people, I'm 40, so people of my generation are like, holy crap, it's only gotten worse. I mean, in the amount of, in Angela Davis's organizing career, we've gone from 200,000 people in prison to 2 million people in prison in this country. That's problematic. That's, you know, that's something that we need to look at, obviously. But it's really important for us to think about how are we going to sustain ourselves as people who can do this for the long haul.
And what I'm learning too, and in fact, you know, what Jim and I talk about a lot is that I'm new to this social movement world. Actually, since Jim and I were married, which is going to be 3 years in a couple of weeks.
Yay!
It's right. And I tell him all the time, I have been stretched out in all the most important ways in really, really getting in touch with what is going on. I mean, this Canadian girl was not a part of this culture. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that really comes to mind, of course, wearing my psychotherapy hat, is how personal relationships also have to be coveted. And in the midst of the social movement and the work and the cell phones and the computers and the live streaming and the shows and the podcasts, how important it is that we take care of our personal relationships, of our families, of our marriages. I mean, you look at the divorce statistics that I was citing, 72% of third marriages end. And I'm wondering, and I don't know if we're going to have a lot more time to talk about this. This would be a really interesting subject to discuss, how marriages, the marriages are doing with the activists who you're involved with, in the social movements that you're involved in, when people are rarely home, and how one needs to find better ways to juggle all of this so that there's going to be more focus, I think, paid on the personal relationships, not only on what's on, in terms of what's going on politically. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that way as well?
Yeah, I can actually speak to that from experience, because I was definitely somebody in social justice that was like, yeah, okay, great. Well, let's move on. Like, we need to talk strategy, and it's very nice to meet you, but okay, all business, And being a part of groups over the years, I realized that you're only as healthy as the culture of your group.
Exactly.